Blog Talk Radio.
Let's go. Yeah. Ghetto children singing. See, they eager to learn how to become the next world leaders. Brave hearts, revolutionary warfare, warfare, love and war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Revolutionary warfare, warfare, love and war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Book one, strategy, tactics, techniques. Look dumb, but masterfully notice the weakness in all them. Gotta you show me if necessary. Homie, vestige is very real if enemies carrying heavy steel. Beware the thugs who ain't scared of blood or jail time. When Aryan nations ain't having integration, we so blind the beauty of life. But when my mom said again, you could be Christ. I wasn't old enough to hold my d***ing P-right. Jesus, what is he like? I picture him standing with diamonds on him. Little different from the way my mommy saw him. Practice your aiming, physical training and difficult terraining. Test your endurance, try to keep your stamina banging, splitting duchess up, strap up. The armies of school, teaching smart ways to go. I'm thinking Gandhi was a fool, the chronic's a fool. Got me thinking out loud. Sleep on my drunkenness, I blow your brains out. Revolutionary warfare, warfare, love and war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Revolutionary warfare, warfare, love and war for the cause. I gotta take you off here.
My revolution is as real as Bobby Seals I build. With dudes and cribs worth a quarter mil in Dick's Hill. For fish gills, the cops love. The time come, I mask up and get my comrade off the bus. Up the beef, I snatch a seed from Chuck E. Cheese and feed them to the rats in the back of the peas. Black fatigue and off the scenes on a sofa. 50-inch flat screen, Louis Vuitton holster. My motions don't appeal to appellate division. I did it strong for 7 long years in prison. Up the system, I'm like a modern-day Hitler. Black gorilla, crib and blood in one only. Just know my face, I be the case. But the wish at the police, they'll get the name Lake. Go simultaneously with street revolution. 21 gun salute, the new Huey Newton.
Revolutionary warfare, warfare, love and war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Revolutionary warfare, warfare, love and war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Teach our woman how to hold a family down in case something happens to us fathers. Protect the children, grab revolvers. The woman plays an important part of our life force. Of what we fight for, my heart goes to you beautiful wife in war.
And listen more and talk less. Watch all and trust none. Demand your respect. And be ready to die for what you believe in. And ride all the time, not just when convenient.
Justice and freedom, wisdom and understanding. We the lost children of Israel in this Western world region. You ain't a man, you a coward if you can't support the girl you put a seed in.
Strong rule the weak, but the wise rule the strong. It's more to a war than just getting it on. Seal your form, cover your tracks, stay prepared. I don't care, no one's spared.
Revolutionary warfare, warfare, love and war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Revolutionary warfare, warfare, love and war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Revolutionary warfare, warfare, love and war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Revolutionary warfare, warfare, love and war for the cause. I gotta take you off here.
I'm a soldier for life. The battle I'm fighting has no ending. To struggle is to go the distance. To win is not to care how far one must go.
How you feel?
Fine, sir.
How you feel?
Fine, sir.
How do we get access to this, Jackson?
His lawyers say they can get me in posing as a legal investigator.
You were Huey Newton's lawyer.
Yes.
And now, Mr. Jackson.
Mr. Jackson was sentenced 1 year to life for a $70 gas station robbery.
We have 2 hours.
Waiting a long time.
We need brothers who can maintain their self-respect in here, have true strength.
Some people are comparing you to Eldridge Cleaver, Richard Wright, Du Bois. How does your fame affect you when you're locked up all day?
Free the Soledad Brothers!
Free the Soledad Brothers!
Do you understand that there cannot be a peaceful revolution?
Okay, gentlemen, we're taking over.
Mr. Jackson, sorry about your brother.
He will live to regret it. I'll see you today. Get him where it hurts.
Starring Gary Dordan from TV CSI.
This is the military, David.
Free line. Revolutionary Grid. Welcome to another edition of Georgia University Radio. I'm your host, Bumani Shakir, where our goals are fivefold. Our first goal is to eradicate functional illiteracy among new African prisoners. Our second goal is to eradicate cultural ignorance among new African prisoners. Our third goal is to transfer the criminal mentality to the new African mentality. Our fourth goal is to assist in the rebuilding and stabilization of new African communities. Our fifth goal, prepare the new African prisoners for release, reduce new African recidivism. And our overall goal is transferring the whole prison slave complex to the prison system, to the big institutes of learning, education, and means. Before I bring in our guest tonight, I'd like to go a couple of events that happened in history during this week. On December 11, 1899, George F. Grant passed the Gog T. In 1917, 13 new African soldiers were hanged for alleged participation in the Houston Rebellion. In 1943, Duke Ellington, New World Economy Premier to Carnegie Hall, Ellington said he visualized this new world as a place in a distant future where there'll be no war, no greed, no categorization, no non-believer, where love was unconditional and no pronoun was good enough for God. On December 12, 1870, Joseph H. Rainey, the first new African House of Representatives, sworn as a congressman from South Carolina. In 1872, Attorney General George Williams sent a telegram to Acting Governor Pinchback saying that the black politician was recognized by the president as the lawful executive of Louisiana. In 1938, U.S. Supreme Court ruled in Missouri ex rel gangs that a state must provide equal education facilities for new Africans within their boundaries. Lloyd Gaines, the plaintiff in the case, disappeared after the decision and was never located. In 1963, Kenya gained its independence. Also in 1963, Dr. Francis Fanon published his book, The Richard of the Earth. Also on December 12th, 1975, the National Association of Black Journalists was founded. It became the largest media organization for people of color. On December 13th, 1903, Ella Baker, who was a political activist, was born. In 1945, wishing the birth of Jeffrey Katari Calder, one original organizer of the Black Organizing Committee, former political prisoner, and he's one of the martyrs of the Black August Memorial. 1986, former Black Liberation Army, Black Panther Party, and New African anarchist political prisoner Kwasi Balogun returned to essence. Also, on the same day, Mama Ella Baker returned to essence. In 2005, Santuku Williams was executed. On December 14, 1966, Department of Justice announced a nationwide computer network for the FBI. They exposed the internet for real to the masses. In 1968, class at San Francisco State suspended after demonstration by the Black Student Union and the Third World Liberation Front demanding Black study programs and more non-white students and teachers. Also on this day, it's the birthday of Ernest Immaculate Gaulder, the son of Katara Gaulder, and also the birthday of Hodari Shakir for August 3rd Collective. On December 15, 1770, Jupiter Hamill born into slavery. He published the first known poetry by a new African. 1864, the 15th to the 16th, in one of the decisive battles of war, two brigades of new African troops helped crush one of the South's finest armies at the Battle of Nashville. New African troops opened the battle on the first day and successfully engaged the right of the rebel line. On the second day, Colonel Charles R. Thompson U.S. Brigade made brilliant charge up Overton Hill, and 13 USCT sustained more casualties than any other regiment involved in the battle. In 1911, William A. Hinton, developer of the Hinton test for diagnosis syphilis, was born. In 1950, Sylvester James Gate, extraordinary inventor and scientific genius, theoretical physicist, was born. On December 16, 1859, John Copeland and Shields Green, two new African members of John Brown Band, were hanged in Charleston. 1875, William J. Whipper, elected judge of the Circuit Court of Charleston by South Carolina General Assembly. Governor David H. Chamberlain, acting in concert with white Democrats and conservatives, refused to sign his commission. In 1930, J.L. Chestnut was born. He was a new African attorney who represented various civil rights leaders during the struggle for civil rights and against segregation. In 1961, the Spirit of the Nation, on Kuntu Way, Seasway, the military wing of Africa, on December 17, 1996, Kofi Annan, veteran diplomat for Ghana, named Secretary General of the United States. Also on December the 17th, it will be the 8-year anniversary of Jordan University Radio. December 17th, it made 8 years that we've been online and propagating, sharing this information. You know, and we thank everybody who've been listening to us, supporting us over the years. We thank everybody who's doing the work, you know, who currently organizing and educating the community respectfully. And we salute everyone. We salute all our new African political prisoners, all our new African capture citizens, all the POWs. And we also want to salute all our founders and organizers of GJU and our workers. You know, tonight we're going to be talking to our chancellor of Georgia University, also our co-founder and our primary theoretician, Bob Abdul Lugabasekir. I'm about to bring the Conrad on now. Jumbo Conrad, your line open. Oh, no, my bad. Hold up. Jumbo Conrad, your line is open.
The Jumbo White Gang in Wednesday.
Yes, sir. That's where we're talking now. Way away, my Wednesday. Yeah, man. Yeah, you know, it's good to hear you on the broadcast, man. Good to see you still among us living, man. Still pushing forward, man. You know, and propagating and educating in regard to your circumstance, you organize the way you at. That's a good thing.
Can't stop, won't stop, you know.
Yes, sir.
Can't use our environment as an excuse for doing nothing. As long as we can breathe, talk, and walk, and fight, and do what you have to do.
Yes, sir. That's the commitment. That's the commitment, you know what I'm saying? When people take these oaths, these new African oaths and other things, and these creeds, and start living by certain things, they're obligated by birth. By blood and birth, man.
Blood in, blood out, you know?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Hey, yes, sir, man.
Yeah, one of the things I think is important, right, a lot of people, when they read Blood in My Eyes or other writings by Comrade George, they totally, I don't think they really get what George means by a brother without ideology, we end up in the morgue. That's not just the male, but a race itself, right, even an organization. And this is important. This is one of the reasons why we have all the dissension within the movement. This is one of the reasons why you have 40 different type of Black Panther parties. PE is one thing. PE, political education, specifically deals with overall education, history, culture, you know what I'm saying? It is not specific to the organization itself, but it includes organization politics as well, right? O&I specifically deal with that particular organization. O&I means orientation, indoctrination to that particular organization. If you look at the movement now, even within different these groups, and you talk to certain individuals, that same group, they have different perspective on their group, different perspective on their beliefs. PE alone, political education alone, is not going to facilitate ideological cohesiveness. O&I will, just like within our formation. There's only one interpretation of our ideology. It's not 10 or 15. There's one. So to guarantee that, you implement and institute the orientation indoctrination process where you're going to learn how we interpret New African revolutionary nationalism, how we interpret New African dialectical materialism, how we interpret New African historical materialism, right? And that's important.
Yes, sir.
Because that right there, it prevents in the future dissension. Whereas you have different formations now that may have 20 different groups. They have their own leadership, but they call the same thing. One of the things that facilitated the demise of the original Black Panther was a lack of ideological cohesiveness. And that's something that plagues our movement to this day. One of the things we learn as New Africans, we learn that ideology is not something that you can import from another country. And one of the things I was telling his brother, because he wanted to debate, I said, I don't do no debating, brother. This is what I'll tell you. You said you believe in Mao, right? He said, yes. You said you believe in Marxists, right? He said, yeah. I said, then they'll tell you exactly what I'm telling you. And he said, what you talking about? Look at the signs that they utilize. They utilize what? Dialectical materialism and historical materialism. Inside of those two things, they have what? Concrete analysis of the concrete conditions. Those three things tell you that ideology is indigenous to the people in question. Also, when you study Mao, you had a lot of Chinese students coming back from the European countries. They were able to quote all the European scholars. Mao shut that down because that information was irrelevant to advancing and building China. But here we are. This when the people lack ideological understanding. I'm going to import a foreign ideology from a foreign land and try to apply to my given situation. A couple of things you have to look at. That ideology that you have imported from another country, it didn't work for them, it didn't. Why would it work for you when the conditions are different? An ideology is a direct manifestation of the concrete analysis of the concrete conditions. Marxism, Leninism, Maoism is not based on the concrete conditions in this country and how capitalism, imperialism is applied in this country. Yes, it addresses the issue of imperialism, but you can go to it from country to country, and imperialism is applied differently. Yeah, they didn't deal with what we're dealing with here. This is the most advanced stage of imperialism, colonialism, racism, fascism. They have never seen this before. Their ideological development and perspective is based on what they've seen, what they've experienced. It's like we're trying to get a circle and force into a square, and we sit and wonder why that square, it won't fit into that circle, or the circle won't fit into the square. It's not based on the understanding of that square. Because if you analyze the square, you understand the circle is not going to fit in there. So you have to concrete analysis of concrete addition, find where it fit in at. That's ideology. The ideology is based on the people in question. We have an ideology that evolves right here in our struggle in America that's indigenous to New African / Black people. When you go back, you look at the founding, the forefathers of New African Revolution and nationalism, the forefathers of independence who fought for land. They are the construction, or they are the construct that design our ideological perspective. If you go back and study, you don't need to study Marxist when you got David Walker. You don't need to study Mao when you got Demar Vesey. You don't need to study Lenin when you have Martin Delaney, Henry Garnett, Tunis Campbell, Henry Adams, Gabriel Processor. You do not need to go over there because our founding forefathers here, they taught us what it would take. They developed our blueprint. Even when you go back to the late 1800s and early 1900s, when our ancestors were building these towns and communities throughout the country, independent, control everything and own everything in the communities before it was burned and destroyed by this fascist state. Those blueprint was based on not Marxist, not Lenin, not Mao, but the blueprint was based on David Walker, Martin Delaney, Demar Vesey. They developed that blueprint. But I don't understand how we 200-300 years from, you know, from that point, over 100 years from that point, we try to change the perspective. Our ancestors built independent communities and towns right here successfully in the late 1800s, early 1900s. That is a clear example or testament to the fact that We have the ideological development right here. We have the blueprint right here. It's important. Marxist, Lenin, Stalinism, and all this other stuff did not provide us with any independent community. Nothing. Zero. Zip. But the ideology of our ancestors helped our ancestors build independent towns, independent community. None of them studied Marxist. None of them studied Mao. In fact, some of those isms didn't even exist at the time. Our ancestors gave them their blueprint. Many of them were former slaves or one generation from slavery. That is a concrete analysis of the concrete conditions. They knew what they had to do based on those conditions that exist. So we dismiss all that success, and we want to import a fair ideology that didn't work for Marxists. China is one of the most fascist, capitalistic, imperialist countries on the planet, next to America. But, oh, I'm going to import your form of communism over here, where it's not working over there. But yeah, I'm going to totally dismiss our own history. That's where you got historical materialism coming to play. Our own history and the struggle of our people tell you that we have a blueprint. We have scholars and philosophers and theoreticians that provide us the path, that provide us the way, the blueprint. But what they say about us as a people, we question the intellectual development, political development of our own people. Because if you study our forefathers, you study Demar Bessy, Martin Delaney, David Walker, Henry Garnett, and others, you study them. Study what they've written. Study what they did. They're fighting for land. They're fighting for self-government. They left us lessons and blueprints. Why in the hell would I go to another country where it didn't work for them? Where we have a living example here. And when you look at the late 1800s and early 1900s, our ancestors used their blueprint to build towns, communities. It went through the crucibles. We now understand in order for us to establish a secure land and community, we have to have a military in place that will allow us to secure our territory.
Yes,
that's the learning process. That's the process of dialectical materialism. That was the primary contradiction. Our ancestors who built those towns and communities did not have the military capacity to defend it. That's the contradiction. We have resolved that contradiction in our applications of the science now. In order for us to create a secure community, secure land base, we have to have a people's army committed to securing that process. So we don't have to worry about racist dogs and pigs and other animals coming in to try to harm our people. We have the capacity to defend them, defend our land, defend our communities. We learn that from that contradiction. That's New African dialectical materialism. You will always, even to this day, like I said, when we deal with New African dialectical materialism, the resolution of contradictions is an internal, is a continuous process. Because you may have a primary contradiction today. Once you resolve that primary condition, what contradiction, whatever your second and third level contradiction was, they're going to become your primary contradiction. But each time you resolve that contradiction, it represents movement, the laws of motion. You move from one stage of development to another. It's a constant. You can't get away from that. Even if you remove the word science and dialectical materialism, it's an inherent process in nature itself. It explains how we got here. Maybe you go through the religion definition or the science definition. Science is in both. You cannot remove that. But we as a people, as a movement, we have totally dismissed that, undermined it, and that's explaining a lot of the chaos that exists in our movements and organizations to this day. Within our organization, we implemented a structure called ONI. Prior to that process, you can come among our collective and you can go to an exercise yard and you might have 5-6 different interpretations of who we were and who we are. Because at that time, we did not have that proper ideological development in place. We had PE. You had people teaching ideology. I'll give you another example. You can go to that yard and you may have a brother at the stage of black nationalism. You may have a brother at the stage of revolutionary black nationalism. You may have a brother at the stage of new African revolution nationalism. Those stages of ecological development are going to exist no matter what, because you have to go through the crucibles and fully understanding the application of that particular ideology and its embracement. But the R&I process is going to bring you up. So you can go to yard and you have this chaos. That organization cannot grow or develop when you have that chaos. Not only do you have a chaos, you have the potential for a what? A fifth estate. Dissension, coups, people breaking off. I like his interpretation. Or I like his interpretation. But that's not the organization interpretation. That's not what Comrade George Katar, W. Nolan, Howard Toll, and rescuing comrades who sacrificed their lives. That's not the ideology. So you belong to a different party then, because that's not the party you belong to, because that's not our ideology. When we implemented the orientation indoctrination process, we provide lessons on ecological development. First, understand what ideology is and how it evolved. In order to understand how it evolved, you must understand the science of dialectical materialism and historical materialism. You have to understand that science, because it's through the process of dialectical materialism that these ideologies evolved. For example, we was at the stage of nationalism back in the 1800s. But our ancestors at the time realized nationalism was not the answer. It didn't get us nowhere. So we put black nationalism. That became the next ideology. It did not achieve the desired objectives at that time. I'm just being short, but each time it took long periods of understanding that. You know, it didn't happen overnight. It took some decades, some 50, 60 years, right, to come to that conclusion. But it went through the crucibles. And as it went through the crucible, our people realized we were stagnant. Black nationalism was not the answer. So we moved forward, say, let's say the 50s, 60s and up, where the seed of revolution in black nationalism was being nurtured. Then we realized this being a revolution in black nationalism was not the answer. Through the crucibles, understanding dialectical materialism, historical materialism. Then we say about the middle 60s, the new African revolution nationalism began to evolve. But that seed goes further back, because you can still be at different stages of development in your understanding as you evolve through the crucibles. So then you have 1968, where the new African independence was signed. That represents another development in our ideology. Who knows, 20, 30 years from now, it's going to evolve. Just like when we say, and I made a statement before, we say, okay, here go five states. 40, 50 years from now, it may include 20 states, because our people now will understand the five states are isolated. The five states is surrounding. Behind the five states is the ocean. So we have to think strategically as well when we deal with landmass. Those are thoughts that our future generations are going to have to assess. So the Republic of New Africa, 50 years from now, may look different than what it do now, because they're going to go through the crucibles and go through a theoretical stage to practice. That's a scientific process that you cannot dismiss. It is inherent within the struggle. If most of our people understand that process, we'll be way better off now. All you have to do is look at the conditions and state of our movement and these different organizations and have an honest look. When you apply the tools of dialectical materialism, you have to apply the tool of self-criticism and criticism. Constructive criticism. You have to do that, because if you don't, you'll never acknowledge your mistakes. You'll never acknowledge the contradictions. You will continue to walk in that contradiction. You'll continue to walk in that mistake. And that's why a lot of different organizations are stuck and they stagnant, because they have yet to correct the contradiction. And again, another example, and I'm always explaining this when it comes to when the Black Panthers start passing out grocery bags full of groceries. that's not going to end hunger or starvation. The Black Panther Party did not do that just to placate our people, but just as a first step towards addressing the issue of hunger and starvation. Before we can start to build our farms, we have to first start somewhere else to address the immediate issue of hunger and starvation. Passing out grocery bags, developing community gardens was just some of the steps, but it was not the answer. Many groups use that now as the answer, and that's not going to eradicate or it feel good to give out a grocery bag. This has nothing to do with how you feeling good about or patting yourself on the butt. This is about resolving a contradiction, and that contradiction is hunger and starvation. You must control your food source to facilitate that process. If you do not control your food source, we're going to continue to have people, our people in the community, hungry and starving. Because you can give me a grocery bag today. It doesn't mean you're going to give me one 3 days from now when I run out of food. We've been in that constant struggle looking for food. Nothing really changed. You gave me enough food to eat for 3 days. Okay, that's good. I commend everyone that do that. That's not what I'm doing. I'm not attacking that. But if we're trying to eradicate hunger and starvation, not placate it, after 3 days when that food is over, what do I do now? How do I feed my kids now? If we don't control the food pantries in our community, let's say the food pantry says, hell with it, we're going to shut down. Where do we go now? You ask that question now, not when it happened. That's the science. That's dialectical materialism. That's the science and the struggle. You ask that question now. That means while we feeding our people and passing out these grocery bags, we're also working on developing our own community-based stores controlled by the community. Expanding our community garden program where we utilize every damn space in the community, even in the housing projects, to grow food for our communities. To acquire land to develop the people's farm that will provide our community with food. Develop our own pantries. Every element of facilitating food must be controlled by us, not your enemy. That can't be done. So what I'm saying, I contrast use this as an example because you have a lot of people out there that is on the front line that are politically immature. They cannot accept criticism because they take it personal. They say, man, we've been passing out grocery bags for 2 years. I say, that your response tell you something then, right? 2 years you've been passing out grocery bags to some of the same people. So you're looking at it from an emotional perspective, an ego. And what you talking about, Abdul? I say they still hungry, right? Yeah. Okay, then what you trying to accomplish? You want to stop the hunger, right? Permanently, right? Passing out grocery bags is not going to do it. Is it necessary? Hell yeah, it is. Continue to do that. But we must also work towards establishing our own food source, controlling our own food source so we can eradicate hunger and starvation. That is the application of dialectical materialism. Because if I'm passing out food and I'm saying, well, I want to eradicate hunger, well, hold up. There's a contradiction now. Because the grocery bag is not going to eradicate hunger and starvation in our community. You have to correct the contradiction to move forward. You have to implement a three-pronged process. Grocery bags, community gardens, and acquiring land. And in that process, I'm going to turn the light on. And in that process, you'll be able to fill in the gaps like, okay, we need to develop our own manufacturing company where we develop our own packaging company. We have to develop our own pantries with food that come from our farms, you know. And in the meantime, you may accept food from farms of people who are sympathetic to our situation or sympathetic to the revolution, right? But at some point, we must control our food source. We must control our water source. The science tells us that we must do this. You go to certain places in the United States where the community is predominantly New African. The water source is poisonous. It's causing our people physical harm. That reality in itself, the government don't give a damn about the health of our people. That's a fact. That fact alone tells us that we must develop our own water source. Is about the revolution or not. That's the bottom line. And based on our actions and decisions that we're making, nah. We just trying to get along. We just trying to get by. That's not revolutionary. We're not trying to get by. We're trying to establish an environment, a place where we can coexist, live independently, and do for ourselves on every level. On every level. Education, economic, political, military, social, culture, on every level. It is our job to lay down a blueprint for the next generation to build and the generation after that. That's our job. Our primary objective right now is the stability of our community. Can't get around that. That's the foundation that will allow us to build independence. That's the environment where people can look and say that's self-government. Because if we can't govern our own community, get the nation shit out your head. If we can't resolve those daily contradictions in the community from hunger, poverty, pay brutality, functional cultural illiteracy, unemployment, if we cannot resolve those day-to-day contradictions that exist in our community, get nation out your head. Because before you can even begin to govern the nation, you have to first govern your community. You must control the land base in your community. Can't get around that. I don't care where you at. You can't get around that. That is a fact. Not because I say so. Help me understand how you can control land without controlling the land where you live at. It starts somewhere. Not all our people at once can go to the five states. That is a concrete fact. We must first stabilize our community. We must first come together with this common goal and stabilize our community. And that can be done without working with the pigs and the government. It can be done. This, again, and most leaders that respond to me, they respond emotionally because this is the first thing they say. So you trying to tell us we ain't doing nothing? We out there every day. I didn't say that, man. I commend you. You is out there every day. You is on the front line. No one dispute that. Nothing came out of my mouth to say you wasn't. See, when you're emotional and when you're taking this stuff personal, you're thinking from a subjective standpoint. It's about you. It's not about you, man. Shut the hell up. It's about the people. It's not about what you're doing. It's about how that is impacting the people in our community. It has nothing to do with you. And that's the problem with a lot of these different groups and leaders. They put themselves before the people. It's not about you. I don't give a damn what you do. You can be on the streets every day passing out food. So what? How is that impacting the people that you're serving? So every day I'm going to be able to eat because of you? That's not reality. Because you are depending on them food pantries. Belong to us at all. You depend on donations. You depend on sources that we have no control over. So let's say when you lose that control or that source, then what happened? Those things are inevitably going to happen. Can't get around it. Because we don't control our own food source or water source. We don't control our own food source or water source. If we fear about nation building or we fear about freedom and liberation, you can't be serious if you constantly depend on the very forces that are oppressing us. You can't be that serious. You can't. Our actions and deeds is going to reflect what are we trying to do. If we fight for independence and we serious by independence, then you have to deal with those communities. But you also have to still, no matter what future society that you're trying to build, it always going to come down to the community, first and foremost. Can't get around it. Even if you say, well, I'm not a New African, Abdu. I'm not fighting for New African independence. Okay, good. What are you fighting for? It's still going to include the stabilization of our community, no matter what. We make all these excuses. Well, okay, I'm not a New African, so I'm not fighting for New African independence. Well, you are fighting to eradicate hunger and starvation, right? You are fighting to create secure and safe communities, right? You are fighting for independent schools that are going to teach our true story, right? You fighting to eradicate unemployment. You are fighting for the ownership of all businesses and homes in our community, right? We have that in common then, because that's what we're fighting for as well. We're fighting for the same thing. What you do after that is from your perspective. What we're doing is establishing these independent school, I mean, independent communities that will eventually at some point be the power base by which we liberate ourselves and form our own independence. That's science. Even when we use the chess analogy, it's a scientific process. Think before you move at all costs. Every move you make, you must think and ask why, ask yourself why. Ask yourself why. What are we trying to accomplish? But, I mean, the reality and unfortunate is that we as a movement, for the most part, can accept criticism. Because even as I speak and I say this, well, who in the hell you think you is, Abdu? I say, I'm just Abdu. I understand the science. Even if I don't say nothing, you can't tell me that science is not involved. So I ask the person, you doing the same thing that the Panthers did in the 60s, right? Yeah. Then you don't understand the science then. Because even those original Panthers will tell you, man, you stuck. Some of the things you're doing now didn't work for us back in the 60s and 70s. The condition is different. Imperialism is more advanced. How do you think it's going to work now? But we always take the criticism personal. Because it's not about the people, it's about you. You made it about you. King Fufu or somebody, you know? It's not about you. You know, if the people can only remember you and not remember the people, then you've done wrong. I wrote a post a couple of days ago, and I said bluntly, I don't care if you know me. I'm not here for you to like me or dislike me. I wouldn't give a damn what you think or say about me. It doesn't matter. It's about the people. Now, you harm the people, and I'm in your area. I guarantee you, I do everything that I can, excuse me, to put a stop to it. You can rest assured of that. Been there, done that. So I don't care what you think about me. It's about the people. It's about our communities, our future. That's it. So you can criticize me all day, but what difference between you and me, I'm going to accept that criticism and make that assessment. If it don't apply, then I push it to the side. If it do apply, I'm going to use it to make that correction on the bad behaviors or bad decision that I make. Because I am a professional revolutionary guerrilla. I understand it has nothing to do with me. So if a person criticizes my behavior, my action, the way I talk, whatever, that's harmful to the struggle, harmful to the revolution, harmful to the people, I'm going to sit back and analyze that. And self-reflect on how it applies to these behaviors. And if he's correct on that, I'm going to make that change. If she's correct on that, I'm going to make that change. You can believe that. It's going to be incorporated into the steps that I have. It's not going to happen overnight, but you can rest assured I'm taking that information. I'm going to use it to become a better revolutionary. I'm not going to get all emotional and sucked up, man. Who that motherfucker he is? Now, who in the fuck do you think you is? Well, you can't accept constructive criticism. Who do you think you is? Because you call yourself General, Colonel, Grand Booba? But that supposed to mean those titles. Don't mean nothing. Don't mean a damn thing. Especially when you impose that on yourself. And in our organization and in our movement, we don't impose positions on ourselves. They are earned. Through our daily activities and sacrifice.
Yes, sir.
What is required of us at a particular time. In order to go to stage one, you have to accomplish these things. In order to go to stage two, you have to accomplish these things. So by the time you get to stage 10, you are fully qualified and experienced to lead. And that means accepting criticism, applying self-criticism, understand the importance of constructive criticism, understand that you don't come before the people. Eradicate your ego. Eradicate all those vestiges of living in a capitalist society, those norms that belong to them, not us. It's not about us, and we have to understand that. That's like when you go home and eat three meals a day on a full stomach, then you try to talk to someone that only eat one meal. Something ain't right with that. You can say the thing you say because you're full. You got a roof over your head, three meals in your belly. Oh, you cool. But the people's not cool. They suffering. You got to speak their language. Like Comrade George said, you got to speak their language. You have to feel their pain. The hell with you. Feel their pain. And until we fully understand that, we're going to be in trouble. When a child walks down the street and she or he is barefooted, clothes dirty, sad, and we don't stop to see what's wrong or how we can help, something's wrong with us. So a lot of times we'll say, oh, shit, that's not my child. I don't know nothing about that child. That's not who we are. That's a capitalist society norm. Anytime you see a child suffering on any level, you should feel compelled to put an end to that by whatever means necessary. We far from being there yet. And I always, again, I'm repetitive in a lot of things I say because ain't nothing changed, and I'm not going to stop saying it. If you sit in front of a TV for 4 or 5 hours watching this sports and all the other dumbass crap, you can sit outside and supervise kids out there playing for 30 minutes or an hour to ensure their safety. But we'll blame the white man, blame the boogeyman, blame the Google man, whoever we want to blame. But we never look at ourselves and see what we're doing. We'll sit in front of that TV for 4 or 5 hours while kids outside playing, and then something happened, and what are we going to do? We'll run out, start throwing bottles and rocks. The white man, I said, where was you at when the white man was doing that? Where was you at when someone was harming that little kid? Where was you at when that kid was starving? Where was you at when that guy was beating on his wife, our sisters, our mothers? Oh, I was watching the NBA Finals. And you blame that on the white man. You blame that on racism. Okay. Man, that damn racism, man, had me watching basketball all day. Were not for Donald Trump, I wouldn't be out there. I was stuck watching the football game. Yeah. But yet we'll continue to look outward and we never look inward. And that's our problem. We never look inward. Even to this day, again and again, I'm going to repeat myself. Hurricane Katrina is another perfect example. Not one community, I'm not talking about individuals, not one New African / black community in this country is prepared for a natural disaster, even though we've seen what happened during Hurricane Katrina and all these other natural disasters. And one of the first things we did then, we're still doing now, the government is neglecting us, the government this and government that, but then wait a minute, what the hell are you doing? What is stopping you from acquiring the knowledge and skills to take it back to the community, prepare your community for a natural disaster? What is stopping you? Racism? Donald Trump? The Ku Klux Klan? Who? Oh, I forgot. Yeah, Monday Night Football. That motherfucker Monday Night Football is oppressing all of us. NFL, NBA, all of them. They the new oppressor, huh? Oh, silly ass shit. It's on us. Bottom line. I'm not going to let that TV come before the suffering of my people. That ain't going to never happen. Well, I ain't got no time, man. I got to watch. No, I don't have to watch shit on that ignorant-ass box. That box is controlled by the very people that's oppressing us. When we know that our kids are in trouble, we have kids that can't read and write. We have families that are starving and hungry. We got sisters being beaten and abused by these so-called men, punk-ass suckers. But I ain't got no time to help none of them. We got elders that can't do the things they do because they have no support. But I'm going to sit in front of social media all day and just fucking run off with my diarrhea mouth. Play on the keyboards. Read people's minds. spiritual power. But as soon as you step out that left front door, look out that door, see how much power you have. There's no way. I mean, and this is, I mean, you can't get around it, man. When our kids are suffering at the level that they're suffering, that reflects us as adults. Or reflects us as men and women. Keep the racist shit out your brains. Yes, we live in a racist society. Yes, we are oppressed as a people. But it's only successful because we have allowed it to be. It's only successful because we have not done what is required for us to stop it. Our kids suffering because we have allowed them to suffer. Just like the other day, a white teacher called the cops to come arrest this young sister. She's probably like 15 years old. Well, that teacher, no, us, we allow that teacher to get away with it every time. If my child is being disruptive, you call me, not the pigs, or we'll take all our kids out that school. But see, we can't do that. There's too much right there. You know, that unity scared the fuck out of us. Well, we got to be unified when we go down there. Oh, no, I didn't know that now. I didn't know we had to be unified. You know? I go down there and check on my kids, but fuck your kids. But then as soon as something happened, here we go with that spontaneous struggle again. Get out in the streets. Get our signs. Black Lives Matter. This Life Matters. Throw a couple of rocks and bottles. Cut. And then 2 days from there, we're back at home again doing nothing or doing other things. And the problem that existed that caused us to go out to the middle street is still happening now. Yeah, they had two cops putting handcuffs on his young sister. 15, 16 years old. Even all the students in there were saying, wait a minute, you guys ain't going to stop this? Because they knew it was wrong. But where are we again? Where are we? Parents and activists, revolutionaries should be in that classroom tomorrow, every day. Every day. Until that school understands, you don't call the pigs on our kids. You call us if they're wrong. We'll address that issue. And if that person don't have a mother or father, then the community must serve as their parents. But again, that's too much right again. We have become accustomed of working against each other for other people's behalf, not for our own. It's no different when you look at the COINTELPRO. Now, I was talking to one of the original Panthers, and I explained to him that, man, that COINTELPRO, you guys made it happen. We did as a people. And he said, what you talking about, Abdu? I said, check this out. On document, and we're quite sure it's more than that, but on paper, they recruit over 8,000 brothers and sisters. Who you blaming that on? They recruited people from our communities, from the county jails and prisons, to fight against their own freedom. We've done more. We're not for that. Their COINTELPRO would have not been successful. We have allowed our oppressor to use us as puppets to fight one another. Maybe a physical fight, an ideological fight, a verbal fight. But we don't see it. If we're serious about the people, I'm not going to go to the people talking about Maoism. Because the majority of people say, who? Maoism? What the hell is he talking about? They wouldn't have a clue to what the hell I'm talking about. That's when you know it's about you, not about them. And then when you do talk about Maoism, okay, Maoism, what have they done? Show me the success. Show me what it looked like. Because you're trying to teach me about that, and you want me to embrace that. Where is it at right now? Where is it functional right now helping people like us? Where at? Show me. It's no different than what we're talking about. We have to show the people in the community that we are capable of governing them, and they are capable of governing themselves. Saying stop government don't mean nothing unless they can see it, feel it, and touch it, what it looked like. It must go beyond just community-based programs. We must address those daily contradictions that impact our community. Everything that we do inside or outside of struggle deals with the science. It deals with strategies and tactics. There's S&Ts, strategy and tactics, in everything that we do. We think before we move. But when you have an individual who, let me give you an example. Let's say an earthquake hit and the wall fall down. The average person going to say, yeah, it was an earthquake that caused the wall to fall down. A scientist in terms of social political development going to say, damn, what is an earthquake? What caused an earthquake? What is the anatomy of an earthquake? Then they're going to look at the building. What is this brick is made out of? What forces it takes to knock this building down? And then they're going to get information from the earthquake in the building and bring them together to get a complete understanding of that. That's the science. Because the more you utilize that, you're going to get deep and deep into the truth. Because you're saying that the earthquake knocked the building down is superficial. That's obvious. That's why you have scientists that study earthquakes, scientists that study buildings. The struggle is no different. How do we end starvation and hunger in our community? How do we put an end to unemployment in our community? How do we put an end to functional illiteracy, cultural illiteracy in our community? How do we put an end to pig brutality? How do we put an end to the abuse of our women and children and elders? How do we put an end to that? How do we put an end and eradicate drug addiction, violence in our community when we harm each other? How do we put an end to that? It's going to take an S&T, a strategy and tactic, a plan of operation to do that. And it can't be done without working with the pigs and the government. Believe me, it can. No, we don't have all the answers. But we pool our resources together, come together at the table with this common cause, then we can solve that problem. Because each and every one of us possess a piece of that puzzle. No one group have all the answers. And when they say that, they're crap. I wrote a little slogan when I was saying, a person who say they know everything really don't know nothing at all. Because if they knew it, they wouldn't say they know everything. And a lot of times, you have individuals who believe what they say is it. That's it. We don't need to think or go anywhere else. This is it right here. But all those groups that claim to know it all, what success they've had in the community in terms of eradicating all these basic contradictions. If you say you know it all and you got the answers, why are people still starving? They're hungry. Why are we still unemployed, mass incarcerated? Why these same conditions existed before you came around and still exist now? Because you don't know it all. No one organization have all the answers. We have to come together, like it or not. I'm not trying to marry you. You don't have to like me because it's not about how me and you act. It's about what we can do for the people. And I'm not talking about siding up with some coon that's out to destroy the community. I'm talking about brothers and sisters that pledge their life to build the community. We should be able to put our differences aside to build the community, to fight for our people. Because one brother said, man, I'm not going to work with the NAACP. I said, man, I'm not going to work with them Negroes. I ain't talking about them. I'm talking about brothers and sisters like mine from different organizations. That's what I'm talking about. It's no different when we talk about unity. Unity is something that you must work at daily. That's unity. We throw it out there, but throwing it out don't mean shit. Don't mean nothing. Because that same person who say black unity asks that individual, male or female, do you know everybody in your community? No, I don't know everybody in my community. Do you know some of the people across the street? No. How about neighbors, two houses from down where you live? No. Then how are you talking about unity then? Because unity starts at home first. What effort will it take for you to go next door and build rapport with that family? Then you and that family build rapport with the family across the street. What effort will it take? Again, I know you're probably watching soap operas, football, rap, and all the other stuff, BET and all that. But that's your priority. If you're really talking about unity, that means you have to make an effort. Go across the street. Introduce yourself. Talk to them. What can I do for you? What we can do for each other? Then include the next family next door. Unity is something you must work at. What are you doing daily to ensure unity in your community? Yelling and talking about it, don't do it. But you must talk about it. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying you don't. But you must act in accordance to what you're saying. You must show them what unity means. You must be that example. When you out there talking about unity, they must be able to watch you go door to door to build that unity, to encourage them to join you so we can build this unity. You can't go one place and say unity and come back and say, man, fuck my neighbors. Because that's what they see. It's a contradiction. You see that in the struggle all the time. You go somewhere and talk that talk for your personal gain, but then when you go back to the community, you ain't doing nothing to build the communities around you. How many, and I'm not everybody, don't give me, this is not a blanket allegation, you know. But show me a community where we as a people are unified. I mean, really unified. I ain't talking about no superficial crap. Show me a community who have come together to help other people in the community with their homes, their rents, their bills, college tuition, babysitting, clean up the yard. I'm not talking about individuals again. I'm talking about collective people, collective work responsibility, corporate economics, unity, self-determination, those true principles of Kwanzaa, not the one they commercialized during the month of Kwanzaa. What is your collective work responsibility? And that's one of the problems now. The people here, revolutionary, talking that unity stuff, but shit, they not unified themselves. That's why you have 20 different organizations with the same name. You talking about unity? You can't even unify yourself. People want to see what you believe in. People want to see it. They won't be able to touch it and feel it. Okay, that's what unity looks like. That's what collective work responsibility looks like. That's what corporate economics looks like. You cannot contain corporate economics in the seven-day principle, in the seven-day like Kwanzaa. Corporate economics exists 365 days a year. Collective work responsibility exists 365 days a year. The functional application of that exists 365 days a year. Talking about it during Kwanzaa means nothing if you're not applying it for the rest of the days. All right, Bumani.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I'm listening to what you're saying, right? In regard to the O&I process, right? Now, how did the O&I process relate to the process of vetting people for your organization or the security of your organization? How did that coincide with each other?
Okay. Again, when you deal with O&I, the O&I have a process of establishing standards and procedures of your organization, right? What you have to do is this. You have to identify individuals who's pretty much sympathetic towards the cause anyway. That person must reflect some level or ideas of your organization. You just don't go on the streets and recruit someone off the street that's not politically educated. That individual must go through a probationary period. An O&I process, but the O&I process that deals with them would be PE, opposed to the O&I process that deals with the organizational member. So say you just get another brother and sister off the street, they're not political, you know. You give them, for example, okay, on Monday we're going to pass out groceries. Tuesday we're going to hold security in front of these elementary schools to make sure our kids get home safe, right? You've seen them through a probation period. It's not just about just saying you're on probation. You have to work during that month. For 30, 60 days. He's being observed, or she's being observed. But at the time, and this is the thing that people don't get. During this time that they're on the ground doing what they're doing, you must have an intelligent apparatus in place because you're going to investigate who this individual is. You have to. It's no different with the government. The government is going to recruit the FBI agent and say, come on, they're going to check their background. We have to do the same thing. And learning the history of our struggle tell you why that's required. Because some of these cats that infiltrated the party were snitches already before they entered the party. So I'm saying when you're dealing with ONI, you have a you institute a standard procedure on how to recruit. What are you looking for? You just don't bring them into the door the first day. You put them out there and do community work. See how they interact with the people. See if they're going to fulfill their desired objectives or given objectives. How they interact with leadership. You expose certain ideals to them of the organization or to the movement and see how they respond to that. They have to go through a testing process. At the same time, your intelligence unit is gathering information on this individual. He or she would know that. Where they from, where they was at before they became interested in the organization, what were they doing, were they a cop before or a military personnel, or were they in prison, do they have any sexual cases? You have to do your homework before you let them in. Most groups don't do that. So once you go through that vetting process in terms of gathering in enough intelligence, we got all the intelligence we need to determine who this individual is. And if this is approved, then you go through what is he or she doing daily in our organization name or in the name of our movement. You know, you bring them with you. Yeah, check it out, man. We're going to go down here to the park right here and speak to some of the kids. And tomorrow we have another schedule. We're going to go to the elders and help them around their house. You know what I'm saying? Then we're going to do some political organizing here. You may do this for 6 months to a year, man. Because sometimes people, for the first 2-3 weeks, they fired up. In the 6th week, you don't see them no more. So you got to test them. Our process is harder because we're going to test your ass. We're going to run your ass through the ringers because we're a revolutionary formation who believe in armed struggle. And we know what the government think about us. We're going to test your ass. So the ONI process also deals with the vetting process on standards and procedures. The standards of what you're looking for in terms of quality and the procedures by which you recruit an individual. Unfortunately, the Black Panthers during that time did not have that. Most organizations didn't have that. They had open-door policies. You can walk right in. And that's why COINTELPRO is effective. That's why it's effective to this day. All I have to do is put a black leather jacket on, talk that talk, revolution this, guerrilla this, and this and that, and some of these groups let me right in. Not even know who I am, where I'm from. Let me right on in. You know? And, and that's one of, again, that's where science, again, is important and required because as science tell you that you can't do that, learn from the Black Panther Party. Learn from them other groups back in the 60s, 50s, and 70s and early 80s. Take that as a lesson. They tell you right now through that action, indeed, that that can't be done. Don't do that. So look what happened to us. Look what happened to Chairman Fred Hampton. That clown infiltrated the party, was able to move up in ranks in terms of security and become Comrade Fred Hampton personal security. And you look at all that throughout that, you have to look at it from a scientific process, from an objective process, not from a subjective process. Because if you do that, it's going to happen again. You have to look at, okay, just like when somebody get at me and talk about, yeah, man, I'm this and that. I never respond to them. Because if you this and that, you wouldn't be telling me that. Because you wouldn't be contacting me anyway. You see what I'm saying? You wouldn't be contacting me in the first place, either this or that. So you'll never get a response out of me. But sometimes we get too thirsty in terms of our organizational building, and we're not dealing with quality, we deal with quantity. You know, man, I got 50 people coming at me, I'm going to recruit them all. Come on in. Come on in. Not even knowing we're letting all kind of trash and parasites in. But let them on in, because we're dealing with numbers. Nah, we deal with quality. The quality of the individual is going to determine the impact of your organization. Can't get around it. Quality.
True indeed.
You know,
true
and that orientation process and the indoctrination process also deals with vetting standards and procedures. You know, so I mean, you know, it's right. And that's the scientific process in itself as well. Because check it out. The enemy that we're dealing with do that all the time. You just can't join the FBI, the CIA, the Homeland Security. You can't just join those agencies. You're going to be vetted. You're going to be vetted thoroughly before they put you in such a position where you know if you go wrong, you're going to hurt them. Why are we doing anything less? Especially if we're saying we're a government out of power.
If we're a government, what are we doing?
Yes, and if we're a government, we're government out of power, we have to act as if we are in power. We have to create the same institutions that's going to help us get into power. So I'm saying like, and that's the thing. You don't practice and put it in place. It's like we disconnected. And all we have to do is just look around. And people want to open up their eyes and see what's going around them. They'll see what they're doing because it looks good to them. But go to door to door and seriously ask the people, what else do we need to do? They'll tell you, I can't just keep getting these grocery bags because I don't get them all the time consistently. After 3-4 days when the food is gone, there's no more food for me to go get. So what I do now? You have, as a revolutionary organization, you have to ask that question. You have to put in place an infrastructure that's going to address that issue. Don't worry about nothing. We own and control this food pantry. We got a 30,000-acre farm that's producing all kinds of fruits and vegetables, specifically filling that people's store and that pantry. You see what I'm saying? So, I mean, you know, it's like I was telling a Seaman, a comrade, we were talking the other day. I said, man, it's like most of our people, even in the struggle, don't realize how bad it is, man. And if you don't come to terms with that reality, you're not going to respond accordingly. You're not going to respond accordingly if you don't come to terms with that reality. Huh?
It's bad now.
You can see it from, you know, you see it from where I'm at, you know? And every time I hear people saying, man, Abdul, you don't know how bad it is out there, I say, well, a lot of people have told me how bad it is. And I understand that. That's why I did that post the other day, too, when I was saying, I know it's bad. And sometimes I think our people is ungrateful, period, bottom line. Because no matter how hard you work, they're not responding. But what one of the things I say is this here, and I used to tell the comrades this, we're not speaking in a language that they can comprehend. We can't blame them. Do I think that sometimes they're ungrateful? You're damn right. I think they're ungrateful. Because you put everything in place to help them liberate themselves so we can liberate our people, and they still throw dirt and mud at you. But as a revolutionary, you must learn how to dust that mud off, and then you must say, what can we do to help you guys free yourselves and build our community? These are our ideals. You can't give up. And I'm saying this, and it's not easy. You know, especially from where I'm at, you know, because you committed to the struggle, and you giving all that you can, and people, for the most part, will only pay lip service to it. And you cannot let that discourage you, because it will become discouragement. But if you're serious about the people and not about you, you have to shake that off. You have to shake it off. And as for the revolutionary and the activists on the street, you have to shake it off. You ain't got no choice but to shake it off, because it's not about us. Like Comrade George always says, it's not going to be easy. There's nothing easy about this. And many of us are going to be alone because of this. But you have to keep on fighting, because you know it's not about you. The fact that, like I said in that post, I know for a fact at some point in time our people are going to be free. Maybe 50 years from now, 200 years from now, whenever. I'm content with the fact that I have contributed to the process of it. Because I know one day we'll be free, and that will keep me moving. Because I know everything I do today until the last breath is going to help the next generation and the next generation. So 200 years from now, in our community, I mean, our people is liberated. We have our own land, our own nation. I can sit back in my spirit and say, damn, we did that thing. And I can see that now. So that's my motivation, you know. If people ignore me or dismiss me, or I'm going to still continue to fight, you know. And a true revolutionary is built for that. You feel what I'm saying? You're built for that. That's a challenge. And again, the primary battle is inside of you. It's in your head. It's in your heart. That's part of the struggle. You know? So I don't take none of the hits personal. You got to keep on picking yourself, keep on doing it. If I have an ideal and people don't respond to it, I mean, just like when you look at the Solid Alert Network. I've been pushing that thing for 10, 15 years. 10, 15 years I've been pushing the Solid Alert Network. And the majority of people never responded. I'm saying, man, this is about us looking for our kids. Not just looking for them. We're talking about protecting, defending them, and preventing them from getting abducted. You would think our people would be receptive to that. You would think that. But I learned, nah. They pay lip service to it. You know, now there are more people supporting it now, right? But I started that over 15 years ago. But I didn't give up again. If you look at all those proposals that me and the comrades developed, we done while we was in solitary confinement 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago. But we never gave up. We never surrendered them. We kept fighting for it. You know, it's no different when we was in solitary confinement and we was at a point where they said we'd never get out. And we all believe that because many of us was in there for 10, 20, 30, 40 years. We believed we'd never get out of solitary confinement. But we kept fighting. We didn't throw in the towel. We kept fighting. And we, again, from an S&T standpoint, strategy and tactics, we understood what it would take for us to beat this beast, to shut it down. And check that too out. I hear from a lot of activists in other states, right, especially like in Alabama. They say, well, you got the California got it good. You got the liberal government. And it's like, it, you know, at first I took that as a blow. I said, you serious? What you see now is a result of over 56 years of constant fighting. Yeah, you think this? And then when you look at it, from the 60s to now, the majority of the governors in this state have been conservative Republican, not Democratic, not liberals. Everything we have in terms of feed us, shutting down the solitary confinement system, was fought for, and people died for that.
Yeah.
People died for it. This is like, I chew on other activists who think California popped up. What do you think George and they was fighting for? And W.L. Nolan, Death Row Jeff, and Howard Toll. What do you think they was fighting for? The same thing. We continue that same battle. And I be tripping when I hear people say that. Like, okay. We came, nah. And we still got other different issues, but we had a different level of contradiction now. The issue they deal with in Alabama, we deal with that in the 70s and 80s. The issue these other prisoners addressing, we dealt with that. A lot of time, the individuals in those prisons is not fighting. They wait till the last minute when something real horrific happens to start fighting. We've been fighting consistently since the 50s and 60s. Consistently. You see what I'm saying? So, you know, and that's what people have to understand. We at a different level now of the contradiction. And what is applicable to one state now applicable to another state? Just like in the South, the 13th Amendment issue is a real issue because they got them out there picking cotton, all kind of stuff, right? They don't have that in California. They have other certain form of labor in California. So how the 13th Amendment apply here is going to be different than how it applies in the South. And that's what people don't understand, and that's the time of scientific process again. Concrete analysis of the concrete conditions. The conditions in California is different than conditions in Alabama. What exists in Alabama had existed in California at one time. But activists and prison activists was able to come together and stop that. And stop that. So that's something that people need to say. I just had to get that out because I was tripping on one of the sisters I was talking to the other day. She's saying that, you know, you guys got different out there because of the liberal government. I almost hung up on her. But I said, yeah. You know, then you got all these brothers and sisters that have died sacrificing life for what? Just because we got a liberal government? You know? But again, when you know it's not about you, you got to suck it up. I had to suck that up, you know? And I said, okay, you right, you know? And again, when you look at, like, even when we did that hunger strike, right? A lot of people, I mean, for those of us who did the whole entire 59 to 60 days, many of us permanent damage for life. My heart is permanently damaged. You can't undo that, you know? Shima, his liver is permanently damaged, you know? I went from 210 to 129. Heart stopped 3 times on me. I went 60 days without eating, you know, and almost 3 days without drinking water. That's what did it. You know, so a person can't tell us that we didn't sacrifice to get where we at. While at the same time, We filed a class action lawsuit. We've done our legal homework and research. This didn't just pop out of nowhere. We've been filing class action lawsuits since the 60s. You know? So, you know, a lot of things people don't understand, you know? We're at a different stage of the development in terms of our struggle. When you look at Alabama and other prisons, we've been to that stage already. We addressed those issues already. You know? And this is what I want to do, too, right? Because I know a lot of time, Bomani, people always ask me about that Gauntlet War, right? Gauntlet War. And this is something that was unique, for the most part, to California. That's something that a lot of people can't even imagine, right? In California, in San Quentin in particular, even though it happened throughout the state of California, but San Quentin C-section between 1982 and 85 was no other place like that, right? The Gauntlet War is this. And when California was more advanced in weapon making too than most states, you're in a hole now, and you're getting cuffed up. Every time you come out to say you're in restraints, as you walk down that tier, your opposition is shooting everything at you that's capable of killing you, from zip guns, some cases real guns, bombs, crossbows that can go right through you, spears that can go right through you. You ducking and dodging that while you're walking down the tier. Every day your door open up for yard or shower. That's what you have to deal with. You have to say, okay, we're about to go to shower. Now you got to brace yourself because now at any given time something can happen. You might be the target today. Somebody else might be the target the next day. You never know. And then at times, say like what we call the cutout. People would cut out their bars. They accuse me of doing it too, right? You cut your three cell bars. You grease your body down. And when your enemy come by you, he's in handcuffs, remember. You squeeze out your cell and you attack him with a knife. That was part of the Gauntlet War. Or you have, like, the other two races, they go to the yard, we shower. The day we go to the yard, they shower. So what people would normally do is this. Let's say I come back from the shower. I'm in restraints now. Instead of going to my cell and the rookie guard working, I stand in front of your cell and say, yeah, I live right here. He opened your door and let me in there. Take the cuffs off. Once the cuffs come off, you yell down to one of your people, send the line down, and send the knife. You get it, you're hiding into bed. So when that other individual comes to the cell, he's handcuffed behind his back. You jump from under the bed and you attack him. That's the type of stuff that was taking place in C-section regularly. You know, where a prison guard got murdered from a spear, from prisoners being murdered, from stabbing, shot, bombs. And here's the thing I try to explain to people. You had names like East Block was called Little Vietnam because a bomb went off 3-4 times a week in East Block. In C-section, a bomb went off 2 times a week, sometimes more. You know, and I'm talking about bombs that was capable of blowing your brains out, you know, and most people would have never heard of that. You know, and CDC in California never talk about it. It's called tier warfare, but we call it the Gauntlet War because you had to walk down a tier. You know, and you got bombs being thrown at you. I had a bomb thrown in my cell. You know, we got comrades that have been shot. I got shot in the arm. You know, so, I mean, that was and the reason why that's relevant, because that's part of the struggle. We had to live through that while we addressed those conditions. While we addressed the conditions, the living conditions, the food. But we also had to deal with that internal conflict between the different races. We had to address that. You know, and it was bad. But again, when we was telling people, like, we go to the board and we talk about post-traumatic stress disorder, you say, now tell me you can go through that and not have some type of post-traumatic stress disorder. But again, like I said, our condition is totally different than the mother states. And I can name all kinds of stuff where it didn't happen in other states. So every state is unique to itself. And what we had to deal with in this state was totally different. You know? Our actions and deeds is based on our concrete reality. We can't import other people's ideas and beliefs to our situation in California. So it's totally different than Alabama. Where Alabama's at, like I said before, California was like that in 67 and some parts of the early 80s. But we fought. And for a long time, brothers, we were by ourselves. This racial unity didn't happen until the 90s. Prior to that, the New African revolutionary guerrillas by ourselves fighting these conditions. For the most part, by ourselves. You know? But again, it took the unification of the different races, too, now, to shut down the solitary confinement units. You know, it took that collective effort. No race by itself could have done it, and we knew that. No single group could have done it. It had to be a unified effort. The government didn't just decide to stop that. In fact, the government acted like they didn't even know there were that many people in solitary confinement for that long time of period. When they held a Senate hearing, they realized at least 28 of us was in solitary for over 30 years. And they act like they didn't know. But we know that's crap. They knew. But I'm just saying, like, that's something that we had to fight for again, you know? You can apply science to everything, man, you know? And you have to make that assessment with your organization, your movement. You have to make a daily assessment, a weekly assessment, a monthly assessment. You know, what conditions in the state of your organization in? You have to analyze that. Where are we at today opposed to where we were at yesterday or last week or 2 weeks ago? That's going to determine your growth and development. That also going to determine what are we doing wrong. Assess your strengths and weaknesses. You got to do that. That's a scientific process, but you have to do it. You know, and we do it daily, constantly. You know, even when we do the GJU meetings, right? One thing we do, we assess ourselves. What are we doing? What are we bringing to the table today that we didn't bring last week? We have to constantly make that assessment because it's going to help contribute towards our growth and development and our success. So you don't make that assessment, then you'll be doing things like, say, like you may have a program that is not working, but you would never see that because you don't make that assessment. And making that assessment is not just by you doing that. It's by you going door to door where the community exists, asking the people, what impact is our program having on your community? Get their input, not yours, theirs. Take the information back to the lab, make your analysis, assess it, and do whatever necessary is required to rebuild that program to serve the needs of the people. You know, I'm not going to lie. It's hard. I ain't going to lie to you guys. It's hard. And again, you have to keep the people first. Because if you don't put the people first, you're going to give up. You're going to throw in the towel. You can say enough of this shit. These folks don't deserve it. You can get tired, you know. But you have to put the people first and realize it ain't about you. Once you do that, that serves as your motivation.
Indeed.
All right, Brian.
True indeed. Like this, man. A lot of times we look at certain situations. We look at certain situations from a subjective manner, right? But we should be looking at it from a manner of can we actually change the conditions and how we actually can make things better, right? You know, like for instance, you know, if we look at things here realistically, right? We know we got some of the same problems, the issues here where we go from miseducation to poverty. To poor housing, you know, to being racially attacked by the pig, things of that nature, right? You know, a lot of times when you look at it, we had resources to make those changes, right? But instead of coming together collectively or coming together, you know what I'm saying, as a plan of action, something like a strategy, we tend to think individualistic, right? Or we tend to think that, okay, I can be better than the next person, right? You know, and the first step to a lot of this stuff is to change our way of thinking. You know, as long as we're thinking from an American or Eurocentric standpoint, we're going to forever be in the state that we're in. But as soon as we started going through a process of re-Africanization, started thinking like Africans, started thinking communal, started thinking about a community, started thinking from a communal standpoint, and started realizing that we got scientific, social principles, we got principles. We got principles that can change our culture, principles that can change our current surroundings, our environment, right? If we can move better in a collective manner, they're going to be beneficial to us all, right? But it's all started from the education process. You know, it's the education process started first because
you know, if we don't know exactly where we're coming from or know the condition that we're facing, how can we even have any kind of ideas of how to deal with them or how to alleviate them, right? I was thinking to be social scientists. We talking about being a society, so we got to be social scientists. You know what I'm saying? Social scientists are the ones who assess the areas of the geopolitical aspect. They assess the areas of the socialized development, the psychological development, you know, the mindset of individuals and the mindset of the community, the mindset of cultures and different aspects. They assess those different aspects, right? So we got to be the ones that are the problem solvers. We had to be one that had the solution.
Exactly.
We had to be the solutionary in our community. You know what I'm saying? But it first starts within your own family. You know, when somebody say you the black sheep of the family, they really saying you're a solutionary because you think outside the box. You think outside the box. You're the one who really got different thoughts. Now, they may call you black sheep of the family, but still, when things go down, they're going to come to you. We're going to go see the black sheep. See the black sheep talking about.
And let me say this here, right? let me say that and put it in perspective, right? It also depends. First of all, I don't use the terms white, black, none of that, right? My thing is, if you acting differently, right, it has to be a principled way, right? Not just rebellion. Not just I'm going to define the family's unity or ignore the family rules and stuff, right? That this is what I'm saying. I'm thinking differently, but these different thoughts are contributing toward the growth and development of the family now. Even though I'm thinking differently, I'm approaching it differently, but it's benefiting the family as a whole. Because it has to benefit the family and the community. So even if I'm thinking differently, and you say, well, he's different than the rest of us, but is his thought process destroying us or is building us? That's relevant to that process. You know, because if it's destroying us, the fuck, you can keep that thought. You see what I'm saying, Bomani? You can keep that thought. But now if it's helping us to build, give it to us then. Help us understand what you're seeing. And see, and that's why it's important, too, for, like, what you do with the GJU, what Haki Kweli Shakur do with his podcast. That education is designed to plant the seed, to nurture the grounds of the minds and the hearts of our people. You know, and that's why that aspect is very important. And when you speak about like just like when I was engaged and I told you this before, I was engaged in a dialogue through correspondence with a NWCP member back in the 90s while I was still in solitary confinement. And he tried to tell me, he said, "Brother, I think you're wrong. We have made progress." So I got back at him and said, "How do you define progress?" And he went on and on. I said, "Yeah, okay. Let me interpret that the way I see what you just said, right? What you're saying is hundreds and hundreds of years ago, we had 100 boots up our ass, 100 knees on our neck. Now, in 1996, we got 93 boots on our neck, 93 boots up our ass." Okay, that's how you define progress, right? But let me tell you how I explain progress. I don't want no boot up my ass, no knee on my neck. That's what I want. I'm fighting to remove that goddamn knee and remove that fucking boot. That's how I define progress. I don't define progress because you got 2-3 less boots up your ass. You still got a boot up your ass. You know, and I never heard from him again because he had too many boots up his ass.
True indeed. True indeed, man. You know, The whole aspect of the educational process, man, for real, when we go back and look at it, man, you know, educated for liberation. You know, we had a lot of times, you know what I'm saying, what I've been figuring out is that we think that our people know things in which they actually don't, right? Actually don't know a lot of things, you know what I'm saying? We think, you know what I'm saying, like because of the aspect of so many information out here, that they either take down the sophistication, the internet, things of that nature, right? But on the same token, our people have been oriented, indoctrinated to a system that program and condition them to be consumers, to be the human chattel slaves mentally, to be mental menials, so to speak, right? So we got to take it to the process of liberating them, their re-acquisition process, and the process of re-educating them and all that, you know what I'm saying, in order to get them to see things from a different perspective, right? We actually got to teach the people to think, how to think or what to think, you know. Now, in regards to the perspective, in regards to actually being liberated or actually going to gain independence after having the kind of freedom of your mind, your body, and your soul, right? You got to go through those processes with our people, those methodologies. That really, like you said, it really bad how for real, man, because, you know, especially when, you know, you have people that got resources, but they use their resources to enslave others. Or they just use their resources. They just hoard their resources. They don't even do nothing with it. They just have. You might have 6,000 acres of land and 12 facilities, 13 buildings, you know, all this stuff, but just hoard it. Don't use it for nothing. Just have it to have it. Just collect
at
stuff.
All. And that's the norms of living in a capitalist society, individualism, selfishness, greed.
No doubt.
I mean, if you're serious about the people and you got $4 or $5 billion, you know how much good you can do with that money? Seriously, just like when you look at the professional athletes, right? Their PR tell them where to donate money to. Donate money to this here. Donate money. It don't impact our community whatsoever at all. Mm. And that's by design. We have community organizations and programs. If you donate money to that, oh, man, just like the Senate, just like the embassy. If someone were to donate $100,000 to the embassy, man, the impact the embassy would have on the community would be 100-fold.
Yeah, we'll immediately put that to work.
Man, you know,
it's more institution with that one. That institution money.
Exactly.
Institution money.
Exactly.
Money, money.
Open up that store.
Get jobs
open up
and
that,
everything.
Yeah, open up the people's store next to it. You know, there's a lot that can be done. it's like you go to these concerts, and you pay $50, $60, $80 to see this person perform. You pay $20, $15, $30 to buy a CD. And, you know, then I remember when what's that girl named Beyonce? Beyonce came out with a new album, right? This is years, a couple years ago, about 4 or 5 years ago. And she said, I did this album for the people. And if I was face to face with her, I said, check it out. If you did it for the people, why are they buying it then? It's theirs, right? Why are you selling something that you did for them? You ain't doing me no favor. I gotta pay $30 for that shit, huh? You ain't. How the hell you made this for me and you selling it to me? Man, that weak ass. But again, most of people don't see that shit. I'm doing it just for you, Bomani. But give me $30 before I give it to you. I'm not gonna benefit from it.
Well, hey.
Come on, man.
He doing it in name of the people that you know gonna buy.
And then who gonna benefit from it? Her and the record company and the industry. We're not benefiting from it because I'm gonna listen to 16 songs. How many times I wanna listen to that shit? $30? I could have done something else with that $30. Buy some groceries, pay some bills, help my neighbor.
What's really interesting about that? You brought that up. You know, he actually had been a lot of. He has had a lot of influence over the people the last 10 years, right, in various ways.
Yeah.
You know, especially when she dressed like Oshun. They went talking about the Orishas and E-Fi then. She was dressed like she was a Panther member. You know, they started talking about the Panther, all the things of the nature, right? When they do certain things like that, you can look at it from various perspectives. You know what I'm saying? Either you're gonna take the best out of it or you're going to keep the worst. You know, in regard to the situation, you know, and the bad thing to take out about it is the knowledge from it. If you don't take the knowledge from the situation, then you haven't grown from what she was doing. You haven't learned or understand the things she was doing. You're looking at it from an aspect of a symbolic expression of what she was doing. It really didn't make no sense to you. It was just something that was popular at that time or something that people were following. But you didn't take no lessons or no information from it. You know, you lied. No situation. You don't learn the experiences. They can make her better.
Or even enlighten
our mind state.
Yeah, see, the Panthers, original Panthers, the new Panthers, and other groups should have took advantage of that opportunity with regards to the Black Liberation Movement. You know what I'm saying? Because that was symbolic of the Black Liberation Movement, and the Black Panthers was symbolic of that movement. So that could have provided an opportunity to provide a lesson with regards to the Black Liberation Movement, right? But again, it's like the movement is missing these opportunities, you know? And it's no different with the Rodney King situation, no different with all these different situations taking place. The movement, you know, you show up with a bunch of guns and talking and you're gone. That's not how you take advantage of it. That's one way to let the people know that you can defend yourself, you know. So that is a good aspect of it, you know. But you got to go further than that. You got to have programs in place, you know. It's like, man, yeah, go ahead, but my, before I get myself in trouble.
Oh, man, it's all good, man. You know, I'm just taking it. I'm just listening to what you're saying, you know, in regards to that aspect, you know, like in regards to the Black Liberation Movement, right? Now, the Panther, the Black Panther Party started friendly coming to scene in the 66, right? Even around Black Panther Party coming to scene in the 66. Now, if you look at the developments before then, one of the primary organizations that was functioning on a revolutionary black national standpoint was revolution, actually the RAM, right? And
RAM, yeah.
RAM was basically everywhere. But on the same token, RAM had that clandestine apparatus, they had the underground and above ground apparatus,
yeah.
Right? And they knew that they can't be walking around with no guns, and you know they can't be seen visual doing that when they actually trying to build. They trying to build some things.
Exactly.
So they know they can't be seen
exactly.
Doing that. They understand the significance
exactly.
Of it in regards to the image what it looked like, but they also understood that every time we become above ground and build something, we get destroyed before it actually get off the ground. So they moved on
exactly.
The clandestine way, but still functioning above ground at the same time. They had both of the apparatus going on that made them more successful in regard to endeavors. And even that they influenced SNCC, you know what I'm saying, the Highlands
yep.
County, you know what I'm saying, they influenced
yep.
The Black Panther Defense. They influenced the Prison Republic
yeah.
After. They influenced so many people on and on, but they're not talked about or mentioned in a lot of the history. If you look at the Black Liberation Movement, look at the Black Panther Party, or they mention the Black Power
yeah.
Era, you know, or they might mention the Black Arts Movement, you know what I'm saying, during certain times, but organization that really had significance and really did certain things that they moved around with international. They were international before
yeah,
everybody
man,
else.
Exactly.
They were international. They were Malcolm X
yeah.
Was doing.
Like what you just said here.
For the RAM. He was speaking for RAM. Malcolm X was.
Yeah, but see. Yeah, but like what you're saying here in terms of, I'm going to speak by our collective, right? A lot of people don't give our collective that much credit. But wouldn't that for our collective, there would never been no Comrade George Jackson. A lot of people think it started with Comrade George Jackson. It didn't. And he'll tell you that. He mentioned other names in that book that came before him.
I met the
you
Black
know,
Gorilla.
If you look at our movement.
That.
Yeah, you look at our movement. You look at our movement, you see what happened in Marin County Courthouse. You see what happened on August 21st, 1971. You look at our movement. It helped produce Bunchy Carter. Remember, Bunchy Carter was in here before he went to the streets. Elgin Cleaver was in here
yeah.
Before he went to the streets. They
yeah.
Became political and solid there.
Yeah.
So a lot of people don't understand
yeah.
That. Then when you look at the Seminese Liberation Army, it was our comrades that started the Seminese Liberation Army. So I'm just saying, you know, that's one thing. It's like it's a romanticism as it relates to the Black Panther. You know what I'm saying? And people ignore and dismiss the fact that there are many different groups that did just as much. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And there's even groups, when you look at the, what's that, the Black Deacons for Defense, the Blood Brotherhood, all them
yeah.
Groups, Robert Williams, you know?
Yeah.
And it go further back, but, you know, that's something that we have to teach our people about because the blueprint is there. You know, it's not just the Black Panther Party. Many other different formations that contribute, you know? Even when you look in prison during the 60s and 50s, you can't take away from the Nation of Islam. Because the Nation
yeah.
Of Islam have converted four black criminal minds than any other group.
Yeah.
The church, the prison system, I don't care. The Nation of Islam have converted more criminal minds than any other group. And when you look at what was taking place in California, were not for the Nation of Islam, our movement would have never came about. Because
yeah.
Many of them came from the Nation of Islam in the 60s and the 50s.
Yeah.
And it was in the Nation of
Islam
in California.
They made it possible in regards to people having
certain religious rights to be able to practice certain beliefs and certain ideas that there wasn't Christianity. You know, they made it possible in regards to that thing.
Yeah,
that's
see,
why, you know, being recognized.
It's in prison, that took a long time. What I'm saying, in California, the Nation of Islam was the first one to respond to racial violence. Prior to that, it was no response. And that's not just in California. That's throughout the country during that time, especially in California when there was a racial war going. The Nation of Islam was the first one to get on the front line and say enough is enough. And our movement was born from that, where we say enough is enough. It ain't going to happen no more. We ain't going to be your victims no more. But the Nation of Islam is the one that set that platform back in the late 50s and early 60s, before the Panthers did. And if you look at a lot of them individuals like Bunchy, Elgin, all of them that joined the Panther Party, they were all part of that process.
Yeah, they was in the Nation.
Death Row Jeff, Ulysses Daniels, Howard Toe, all of them. Big Jake, they were all part of that process.
A lot of San Quentin Six.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, it's like, you know, and people don't understand that history. They try to separate that history from us, right? And just like when people ask me about that book, A Taste of Power by Elaine Brown, and they read that, being that they don't know the truth, they take that and say, yeah, man, no, you don't know. In that book, Elaine Brown said, well, the guerrilla gangs popped up after Comrade George. The guerrilla movement popped up after Comrade George's death. Are you serious? So I say, I'm not going to debate you on that. Let's read what George said. Do your homework. Even George said, I did met the Black Gorillas, Big Jake, Tony Gibson, William Christmas, and others. Huh? You serious? The Black Gorillas existed. The Black Gorillas was active before George was active. When George was part of the Wolf Pack, the Black Gorillas already existed. Comrade George started the Black Family. But the Black Gorillas already existed before that. Our name comes from the combination of two. And then when you look at Comrade George's history, there's no evidence other than Johnny Spain that Comrade George ever recruited a Black Panther member. And then when you look at what happened in Soledad, W.O. Nolan, Black Gorilla, Young Cleve, Jug, Black Gorillas, they accused Comrade George retaliating on their behalf. The two brothers that was with Comrade George, they say, Fleeta and Jacques Lachette, was also Black Gorillas. When Jonathan went in that courtroom to liberate them brothers, William Christmas, James McClain, Black Gorillas. James Carr, the Black, his general, the People's Army. A lot of people don't want to talk about that. When Huey came to prison, he already heard about George. He sent George letters asking him, do you want to accept his position to the party? George said, yeah. We don't deny the fact that George was a Black Panther. He was a Black Panther. He was a field marshal of the Black Panther. But he never surrendered his affiliation with the People's Army. In fact, from the time he was assassinated, everything he did was in the service of the People's Army. From the courtroom incident, from responding to the situation with WL, and then the thing that happened on the 21st when they assassinated Comrade George. All those brothers, other than Johnny Spain, was part of the Black Guerrilla movement. Can't get around it. You know, but I think that's important for people to understand when they're reading this book, A Taste of Power, where in A Taste of Power, it's telling people that we just popped up after the death of Comrade George, and all you had to do is look at George writings, prison letters, Soledad Brothers, Blood in My Eyes, and other writings by George. He specifically speak about the Black Guerrillas. He just, check this out. He was taught and educated and influenced by the Black Guerrillas. W.L. Nolan being one of them. Death Row Jeff, Ulysses Daniels, Howard Toe, William Christmas, Tony Gibson, Big Jake. None of them brothers were Panthers. You know what I mean? It's like, the thing is, we have to teach history. And I'm, you know, I ain't going to never bite my tongue about our story. You see what I'm saying? And it need to be told. You know, because they'll try to criminalize us because some clown did something contradicting to what we believe. You judge us by those who uphold the Constitution. You judge us by those who uphold the legacy of W.L. Nolan, Jeff Guitar Golden, Howard Toe, William Christmas, Comrade George, Comrade Jonathan Jackson. You judge us by those who have been holding the laws, not those who have contradicted the law, you know, not those who have dropped the torch, but those who have held the torch. That's how you judge us. Just like with the Black Panther Party. You don't judge the Black Panther Party from some snitch, renegade, goddamn cornchair pro-agent rat. You don't judge them by that. You judge them by those like Dr. Matula Shakur, Suniata Okoli, Bunchy Carter, Frank Hampton, Mark Clark, John Huggins, Jaleel Muhtar-Kheem. You judge them by those who uphold that. Asad Shakur, Safia Bakari. You judge them by those who upheld the Constitution, not by those who fell to the wayside, you know. And that's what we ask people to do. Judge us by those who have upheld that Constitution. Don't judge us by that nut on the street doing something that ain't got nothing to do with us, you know. All right, buddy.
We got like 7 or something minutes left anyway, man. So you got to get your final thoughts anyway. About to be over with, man. You know.
Yeah. But what I do want to say is this: with regards to Solid Sugar, with regards to Solid Network, is something that. And there's other, don't get me wrong, there's other black/New African-based organizations that are doing good work with regards to our missing people. The Solid Network is different because we're trying to prevent it from happening. We're providing non-lethal weapons for females, sisters, who are more vulnerable to being attacked, like our sisters that work in strip clubs, our sisters that are prostitutes. Those are people. We don't see them doing criminal things. We wish someone would be more available, better than that, but we're not going to place judgment. What we want to do, if you're going to do that, how can we do it, help you be more safe in doing so? So one of the things we're doing right now is raising funds to buy these key fobs. These key fobs have like a stun gun, an alarm system, and an LED light that you can blind an attacker, right? Those are sisters, you know, and we would not only provide them with non-lethal weapons to defend themselves, but at some point in time, we will also divide them with an alternative way of living. We will also address the sex trafficking issues. Like I said, we're going to be a progressive revolutionary formation. We coming to look for your ass. You know, you just ain't going to attack our women and children. And we ain't calling 911, so that's another difference. We do not work with the pigs or the government. If someone's trying to abduct you, we don't have a number available for you to call. We're coming, you know. So that's where we'll be at in our advanced stage of development. Right now, we just focus on providing information on missing children. We opened up our website. One of the sisters did a good job, a fabulous job, in putting together our website. You know, and if you go to the website, we're going to be adding other information. We'll also be interviewing sisters who was victims of abuse. We'll be posting stuff up like that. We'll be interviewing sisters that work in the streets. One of the sisters is going to also create another organization specifically addressing those issues in terms of counseling. Because that's what she do anyway. Sister Kay, she do that anyway. She's been doing it over 30 years. So she wanted to put together our own group that can provide some form of counseling and assisting with regards to our women and children who are victims of abuse, sexual abuse, physical abuse, you know. One thing we don't do, even though I helped co-found it, I'm not going to be a part of it. My comrade Ashima, he's not going to be a part of it. The sister's going to run that. You know, we try to get guys involved in what happened, exactly what we knew was going to happen. The guys put their egos involved. This is not an issue you're a master at. So we left it to our sisters. That's theirs. They're going to run that. You know, and we're looking for more sisters to participate in this process, right? Now, the guys will participate in it. We will deal with other issues like our community patrol, training, whatever arm acts that needs to be done. So we know there's other efforts, areas we will be working in, right? but it's all under control of our sisters. You know, we can't complain about our women and children being abused or abducted when we don't do nothing about it. And I ask people, especially sisters, how hard is it to post a missing child? How hard is it? Get it and post it up. That's not hard. But if for some reason we can't even do that. That's sad as hell. We can't even take time out, 5 to 10 minutes, if not 15 minutes, to post information about our missing children, women, or elders. But we can use that same time doing jack shit, nothing. Watching TV, on social media, nothing that has no value whatsoever, even though you may claim it does. But what's more valuable than looking for our missing loved ones? Creating a movement that's designed to protect our missing loved ones and those who are still around. What's more important than that? Football? Concerts? Party, club, and what? I don't know. But anyway, it is what it is.
Right,
that's
man.
It, but mine.
Yes, sir. You know, we got like 2 minutes left, you know. Just to give a little brief, little final thought, man.
You love that, man.
Hey, I got my 2 minute left, man. Hey, give a little brief, little final thought, man. Just give a little quote or something, man.
Okay. All right. Final thought is this, man. First of all, we have to understand the first stage of our struggle start within us. Start within us. Before we even start to build a community, even before we start working on our people, we have to work on ourselves. This is not a competition. This has nothing to do with ego. If you're sincere in your fight and service for the people, remember, it's all about them. It will always be about them. You have to set aside your personal feelings. You know, and I know it's not easy. Because sometimes I'd be like saying, man, fuck, you know, but I don't do it. I had to put my personal thoughts to the side and say, wait a minute, man, you're taking this personal. This is not about you. Our people are suffering. Our people are in trouble. And you claim to be a revolutionary. You claim to be a freedom fighter. You are the first responder. You are the first responder. The people want you to respond first. If we were doing our job, they wouldn't be calling 911. They wouldn't be calling FEMA. They'd be calling us. They wouldn't be calling Red Cross. They wouldn't be calling Feed America. They'd be calling us if we were doing our jobs as freedom fighters, as revolutionaries, as community activists. Remember, we've chosen to be who we are. We have taken up this torch, this fight. We can't blame them. We can't blame them. We have to find a language or develop a language that they can understand that will mobilize them into action. We have to look at ourselves. What are we doing wrong? We the one claiming to be conscious. We the one claiming to be revolutionary leaders and whatnot. What are we doing wrong?
Conrad, we talk about hang up by 30 seconds, Conrad.
Okay. And power to the people. Good love. Thank you for coming. Peace, Conrad. Peace, my people.
Yes, Conrad, social love one. Please listen to Georgia University Radio, Georgia University. You can be found on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, or you contact directly at georgejacksonuniversity71@gmail.com. Again, Georgia University71@gmail.com. Free the land, long live the resistance. Peace.